we can see that illuminated sign that marks the end of the journey.
This vaccine will help us get past this pandemic once and for all.
We need people to have faith that this vaccine is safe and that they should take it. The thing that's going to stop us from seeing the end of this pandemic are people going, oh, I'm not so sure.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Roger Hearing.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepke. So today we'll be taking a special look at the Labour Party following its reshuffle in the recent elections. But first, we do need to discuss the pandemic, Roger, because the government may be bringing forward second vaccine doses for millions of people to try to ensure that as many of us as possible are fully vaccinated.
Well, this comes as the Prime Minister says he's concerned about the spread of the COVID-19 variant from India.
And we are anxious about it. It has been spreading. We want to make sure that we take all the prudential, all the cautious steps now that we could take. So there are meetings going on to consider exactly what we need to do. There's a range of things that we could do. We're ruling nothing out.
Well, cases of the Indian variant have more than doubled in a week to more than 1,300 infections, and surge testing is now underway in several locations.
And the government has also not ruled out local lockdowns in the worst affected areas. Now, scientists, including Professor Christina Pargall from the University College London, think that the easing of lockdown restrictions in England should be delayed.
Then we're in a situation where we're going to have to go back to an even harsher restrictions than we are in now for longer as we bring cases down again. And that seems to me a much worse scenario than waiting a few weeks where we are now to be sure that we can open up in the longer term.
Now, this raises the prospect that the government may be forced to slow down its roadmap to reopening, putting Boris Johnson into conflict potentially with some of his own Conservative MPs.
But now let's get to the subject of our special programme. Last week's disastrous results for Labour in local and regional elections, followed by a messy shadow cabinet reshuffle, have raised massive questions about the party's future. Has the party, founded of course to be the champion of the workers, now lost its working class support?
Have the Conservatives snatched that part of the electorate as Labour has become more metropolitan and more middle class, tracking the concerns of a younger and better educated part of the population, but leaving its core behind? Or has Brexit brought about a fundamental shift in the political landscape which Labour needs to adapt to or die?
Well, joining us now is a historian, David Cogan, whose book, Protest and Power, The Battle for the Labour Party, traced the party's story, of course, from the 1980s up to recent times. So, David, thanks for being with us. Welcome to the programme. How big a hole is the Labour Party now in?
Well, thanks, Roger and Caroline. I think Labour Party's in a pretty big hole. I mean, it's interesting that there were some electoral successes for Labour last week, including Tracy Brabin in West Yorkshire, who's now the first elected female Metro Mayor in a new area. But actually, in general, it was a disastrous result. And I think the underlying causes of that disastrous result are not just the Conservatives, you know, basically snatching a lot of support that they did not used to have, but also Labour's total inability to create policies and practice that the electorate warmed to. And I think there's a really fundamental problem of management within the Labour Party, which was shown by both those elections and what happened afterwards.
So an existential problem then, I put it to you. The party, of course, is founded to represent the worker, but its values are not now in tune with people who live in places like Hartlepool. So, I mean, who and what does the Labour Party represent?
Well, I never quite understand what the word existential means in this context because, I mean, you know, it's certainly a crisis. But, I mean, let's look back at the Labour Party history. The Labour Party for 100 years has been an alliance of, you know, middle-class intellectuals on the left. I mean, Beatrice and Sidney Webb were not exactly hairy-handed members of the working class. You know, it's always had that alliance with working class and Labour votes, Labour being trade union votes, which when it comes together, as it did in 45, as it did in 1964 with Harold Wilson, as it did in 97, it is a broad alliance of all sorts of interests that want radical change. And the real problem that Keir Starmer has got is he's neither seen as being radical and nor is he seen as being sufficiently capable of winning politically. If these elections had happened, in my view, a year ago, when Boris Johnson was flailing around and failing in the first wave of the pandemic, Keir Starmer's kind of managerialism, calm, probably would have won him more support, even though he didn't really have any policy. The problem is a year later, you've had Brexit done, you've had the pandemic now being countered by vaccination, Boris Johnson being able to ride that wave, and Starmer's had nothing to counter that with because there's fundamentally no policy. So I don't see this as being a kind of class divide. I don't see this as being Labour really suffering from a lack of inherent appeal in its core areas. I just don't see it trying to get to those core areas at the moment. It's got absolutely nothing to offer at this stage. And, you know, simply being not Boris Johnson is not enough. Mm-hmm.
But those core areas you're talking about, David, tend to be fiscally liberal and socially conservative. We know that from ways they've responded to lots of issues, not least Brexit, of course, immigration being another one. Could the Labour Party line up with those areas and still keep on board the metropolitans, the socially liberal and fiscally conservative side?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think actually, if you look at, you know, there is a template. If you look at the policy development between sort of 94 and 97, when Blair became leader of the Labour Party, and he and Gordon Brown created what was a highly fiscally conservative approach. You remember, Gordon Brown famously adopted conservative spending plans for the first 2 years of the new Labour government. Actually, Labour's got a history where you can be fiscally conservative. That is reason why Rachel Reeves has now been appointed Shadow Chancellor. She comes from being a Bank of England economist before she became a politician. And she's there to show fiscal conservatism, ironically, against the Conservative Chancellor at the moment, who's spending money like it's gone out of fashion and is almost the anti-Thatcherite Chancellor of the Exchequer. So in a strange way, what's happening here is the Conservatives have racked up national debt and national to levels we've never seen before. And in that sense, taken away Labour's, you know, credentials as a high-spending party. And at the same time, Labour's now trying to show it's fiscally conservative by appointing Rachel Reeves. On the other hand, when it comes to these cultural issues and the ones you've just mentioned, I agree, Labour is absolutely torn between its core vote that actually believes in its metropolitan areas and the rest of it, in immigration, it believes in, you know, open borders, it believes in all sorts of issues that are seen as being socially liberal, and it's got this working class vote that has traditionally not done so. And Brexit showed that fault line. And it hasn't found a way of bridging that fault line yet. And the only way you find a way of bridging that fault line is by having up with policy development that actually appeals to that core vote. But as I say, at the moment, there is no policy development that appeals to any vote.
Okay, but in that case, that kind of fiscal conservative, would Corbynites allow that? Because you talk about lack of policy. I mean, in the kind of Corbyn manifesto, there was a huge swathe of policy on offer, but a lot of it was kind of freebies, offering to subsidise many things. Corbynites are still in the party. Will they support this?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting actually at the moment, and if you look at the reshuffle, which we haven't talked about yet, what was interesting about what happened last weekend was this was not a right-left split. What it was Keir Starmer and his people around him. Actually, the ones people they were trying to move and trying to fire were from the centre. People like Lisa Nandy and Jonathan Ashworth weren't of the left. And the divide isn't there. I actually think the battle for the Labour Party, which I've written about, between left and right is almost over in terms of the influence of Corbynistas now. And the reason it's over is not because of Keir Starmer, it's because Rishi Sunak is actually spending far more money than John McDonnell would ever have dreamt of. And so Labour's got this problem at the moment. You have Conservatives spending money, Conservatives talking about levelling up, Conservatives ploughing money into the North. And that actually would have been a core part of any Labour government, you know, offering, except the Conservatives are doing it. So actually, I don't think this is a left-right split within the Labour Party at the moment. What I really think it is a sort of detached leadership that hasn't got a core base of support at all, where Keir Starmer was able to win a year ago at the leadership. And they actually have been engaging in internal politics that don't make much sense in terms of his management of the party. And then, of course, they did a reshuffle that was basically turned out to be a total shambles.
Well, I was going to bring up the reshuffle. So interestingly, John McDonnell said precisely what you just said to us here on Bloomberg Radio in the last few days about Rishi Sunak stealing, if you like, the party's the policies of Corbyn. But I suppose then that brings us back to Keir Starmer himself, the man in charge of the party during the election, the man in charge, in theory at least, of the reshuffle. Is he the man who can actually bring Labour back to the position you're talking about?
Well, I think there are a lot of doubts now about Keir Starmer, about what happened last weekend. And what everybody in the party has known for the last year is this. Keir Starmer did what a lot of leaders do. He came in, he surrounded himself with his own core group of advisors who'd been with him in opposition. None of whom really had much experience in managing the party in the past. What is interesting about the reshuffle is when they were sitting there for 12 hours trying to figure out what to do, there wasn't a single member of parliament in that room other than Keir Starmer. So he wasn't using any of his parliamentary colleagues. Who does that remind you of? It reminds you of Jeremy Corbyn. It's an irony in this that Keir Starmer is as much devoted to his own little coterie of people as Jeremy Corbyn was. Now, the problem with that is there became a sort of loyalty test invented by those people, which then was applied to Angela Rayner. It was then applied to Lisa Nandy. It was then applied to Jonathan Ashworth. And so all of whom were expecting to be moved or fired. None of whom then were, because he didn't have the muscle to do it. And so that's raised questions about his ability to both manage the party, but also then to look forward to what will happen in a year and a year or two's time. Because clearly now, Boris Johnson, by having moved the bill to get rid of the Fixed Term Parliament Act, has the ability now to call a much earlier general election than Labour may have been expecting. And so So the questions about Keir Starmer now are both, what does he really stand for? How does he manage the party so it's effective? And there is this point that in a year from now, it's just possible that the gloss will have come off this government, that Brexit will beginning to affect the economy much more directly, that actually the there will be further mismanagement of the pandemic, and an opposition that's really geared up for an election could do well.
Now, let's talk about Labour and its history, but also its constitution. It was traditionally built on two pillars, the trade unions and the members. And Caroline, both relationships have become quite tricky in recent years.
Yes, in fact, just last night, a senior member of Unite was suspended by the party for allegedly a racist tweet about the Home Secretary, Priti Patel. At the same time, Mick Whelan, who is General Secretary at ASLEF, has demanded party unity and vision in a letter to Keir Starmer and told the Labour leader to disavow recent comments by the former Cabinet Minister, Peter Mandelson. The party membership seems to be split between former Corbyn supporters and those who want Keir Starmer to move the party, Roger, even further towards the centre.
Well, joining us now is Andrew Harrop, who's General Secretary of the Fabian Society, one of the oldest research groups linked to Labour. Indeed, it existed before the Labour Party existed back in the late 19th century. Andrew, thanks for being with us. Now, interestingly, on your website today, you ask, how can Labour re-establish the relationships, communications and values it needs to win back voters' trust and support? All right, what's your answer?
Well, it's a tough question with no single answer. Labour has been struggling for a decade now, but there are solutions if the party starts to unite and focus on winning elections rather than fighting itself. The problem Labour's got is it needs to reach out a really broad coalition of different types of people in different parts of the country. It's the urban liberal voter in places like London or the centre of Manchester, but also reaching out in Scotland and Wales and in those former industrial towns in the North and Midlands that we've been talking about so much. And the challenge for Labour is, how do you bring together people who are really quite different in their outlook and values when it comes to sort of cultural issues, but actually do tend to share quite a lot when it comes to the economic change they want from the country. And the thing that Keir Starmer and his team have got to do is focus on a big story about how they want to change the country in terms of economics, in terms of it being fairer, in terms of a bigger role for the public sector. And that can unify all the very different types of people who don't necessarily share much in common in terms of, you know, their cultural values.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, what are the policies then that Labour needs to put forward and that Labour needs to embrace? I mean, the fundamental one surely is around, can Labour convince voters that the economy is safe in its hands?
That's right. It's partly about the content of policy, but it's just as much about people being convinced that Labour can be trusted with the economy and the public finances, and that it can, you know, it can actually do these things. You know, in the past, people said they liked the sound of quite a lot of Jeremy Corbyn's ideas, but they just didn't really believe that the Labour Party would ever be able to put them into practice. So you need an economic offer that probably isn't very different from the 2017 Labour manifesto, which was, you know, sort of a combination of, you know, sort of, if you like, traditional Labour and Jeremy Corbyn Labour. Some of the policies, you know, Gordon Brown or Tony Blair might have introduced. But the difference between the Jeremy Corbyn era is it needs to sound totally reassuring and safe to people. It mustn't sound like a big risk that people are taking by voting Labour. And the people doing it have to sound like they're, you know, sort of, you know, they're safe stewards of the economy. They're reasonable, measured people. And I think the way to think about it is, rather than it sounding like Jeremy Corbyn, it has to sound like Joe Biden. Joe Biden in America has put, you know, a very radical economic program together. He's spending trillions of pounds. But because of his own personal style and demeanor, and also the senior, experienced people he's got around him, it doesn't sound frightening. It sounds like common sense.
Well, I suppose then, Andrew, part of the issue here, you mentioned Joe Biden. Obviously, the Democrats in the US have a very different tradition to the Labour Party here. And the Labour Party here is historically based on union support, party of the worker, fighting class war almost. Isn't it almost impossible to get rid of that unless, well, do you cut off the unions entirely?
Actually, I think the trade unions have a really big, important role to play, because one thing that Joe Biden's doing in America is trying to revive the role of unions and collective bargaining in the workplace, because it's really important for the future of, future of rich economies everywhere to have, you know, a voice for low and middle income workers, so that they're getting a bigger, you know, fairer share of the economic pie. So there's a really important reason to be backing unions, if you like, from sort of an economic perspective of the shape of the country in the future. Of course, the unions also have a massively important role in the Labour Party. The Labour's always been this sort of, you know, sort of combination of a grassroots members party and an arm of the labour movement, working very closely with trade unions. And that's always been a strength of the party, not just because of the money that some trade unions give labour, but because of the connections it gives to workplaces of all sorts in every corner of the country. And that's particularly important these days, because the makeup of the labour membership has changed in recent decades, and it does tend to be more graduate and city-based than it once was. So actually having those connections with union members does slightly change the mix of people involved in the Labour Party, so that it's not just, you know, sort of primarily a graduate middle-class party, but it has connections with workplaces of all sorts everywhere.
But, I mean, there is perhaps twofold issues with unions, though. I mean, they're on the decline because of the digitisation, the gig worker economy that is kind of revolutionising, in a way, the workplace in the UK, which unions perhaps don't seem to have an answer for, and also the fact that they're within the party, they perhaps still have a stranglehold. So there are some issues with having the unions so entrenched within the party structure.
I think there's an important balancing act to get. So it's absolutely right that no single individual or organisation should be able to dictate what a political party does. And it has gone too far in some in recent years, where that sense of, you know, one or two powerful union barons, you know, sort of trying to dictate what the party does. And that's actually as much about the health of individual unions and having sort of, you know, as a diversity of views within those unions that reflects the diversity of their members' views, as it is about the Labour Party. But it's incredibly important that Labour still has that link to, you know, sort of to people in workplaces up and down the country. So I think trade unions do need to change, but to get rid of the link between Labour and the trade unions would be a real mistake. And a lot of trade unions recognise that they need to reform themselves to organise better in, you know, modern workplaces and the changing economy and the gig economy. Some of them are actually putting a lot of work into this to be, you know, sort of better organised in, you know, sort of basically the new casualised low-income jobs. We've seen, you know, the success of, you know, the case against Uber, a good example of trade unions who are organising in the gig economy. And actually, the trade union membership has stopped falling in recent years. Just the last two or three years, tiny uptake in membership of trade unions, which may suggest that they've at least reached the bottom and are perhaps in a position where they could start to grow again.
Andrew, we've been talking about economics a bit. Let's talk about one thing that many people see as a problem for the Labour Party, which, well, for in kind of shorthand, we'll call culture wars, a sense of the social outlook, social liberalism, which is certainly true amongst the metropolitan, young, educated electorate, and is something alien to a lot of the rest of the electorate. If we want to call it woke values, that's a term that has been used by some people, whether it's to do with sexuality, with race, with all kinds of things that just don't work as far as a large chunk of the electorate are concerned. How does Labour deal with that?
It's a real challenge, and it's partly because the culture of left politics has become, you know, sort of quite sort of insular and narrow, where people, you know, sort of create purity tests for each other, where you're not quite left wing enough or sort of politically correct enough on a particular issue, when actually the Labour Party and the left more generally needs to be outward looking and trying to sort of bring people into its fold rather than sort of exclusive. But there are lots of examples where people are, you know, sort of their credentials are impeccable on equality issues or human rights, but they talk about it in a common sense, unthreatening way, which doesn't sort of alienate people who are in the middle. So the Labour Party will always stand up to open bigotry and hostility and racism. But, you know, that doesn't reflect how most people in Britain are. What you need to do is just to talk in a common sense, everyday language that brings people together. If you think about the change in attitudes to gay rights over the last 20, 30 years, you know, that is the mainstream of Britain changing, that there's overwhelming support for gay marriage now. And that wasn't the case at all 30 years ago. So it's not true that there's sort of a tiny liberal, you know, sort of, you know, sort of clique that's separate from the rest of the country. So Labour just has to talk in an everyday language. So I talked about Joe Biden earlier, and a good example, or at home, someone like David Lammy, who talks about his Englishness in a way that brings people together rather than it sort of feeling like, you know, it's sort of this exclusive, politically correct, you know, sort of group of politicians who, you know, are trying to correct people and tick them off all the time.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.